From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll look at the mental health struggles some communities of color and young people face. Then, we'll learn about the Cargill Community Kitchen at the Mitchell Street Library Branch.
This is an opportunity that they probably wouldn't expect at the library because it is non-traditional, but the community meals are my way of being able to break the mold and to show the evolution of libraries.
Plus, learn about the original Barbie model at the Wisconsin Historical Society.
One thing that I think is really interesting about the Barbie in our collection is the way it tells a story of childhood from 1961, and it connects so concretely with childhood today.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. July is Minority Mental Health Month. It's a time to bring attention to the unique challenges that people of color face with mental health struggles and care. Suicide rates among Black Americans have risen over the last decade. There is an especially alarming trend among the number of Black teens and adolescents dying by suicide. Eddie Kennedy was born and raised here in Milwaukee and has struggled with suicidal thoughts since he was very young. Now they work to help others through their mental health challenges as an advocate in the Milwaukee area. He joins WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, to share his experience. And a note to our listeners, this conversation is about suicidal ideations and mentions of self-harm.
The American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry is one of several entities that report rates of suicide among Black youth has risen faster than in any other racial and ethnic group in the past 20 years. And some predictors can be community violence, socioeconomic factors, or stress, discrimination, stigma, the things, you know, we hear about all the time that contribute to disparities. When did you begin to have thoughts of suicide, and what was happening to you that those feelings emerged?
Kind of funny how you brought up socioeconomic issues that play a factor into why Black identified youth are engaging in suicide ideation and self-harm, because that's kind of play a part of my story a little bit. So as early as 3 years old, I had experienced thoughts of suicide and was even caught trying to harm myself at such a young age. And I don't want to get too many details about what was going on around that age, but my mother, who is kind of the one person who kind of remembers most of the details, I mostly remember the feelings. You know, I kind of felt this energy around me since my entire life, but she was the one who kind of, you know, saw everything, and she just said that I just wanted to, you know, die. And from what I remember as that young, as a child, I felt like life wasn't really in my control. I really felt like I had like no options in anything. And it's kind of weird, 3 years old, you're feeling that at such a young age. But at that time, something really traumatic happened to me that made me feel like I didn't have, you know, power. I didn't have autonomy. I didn't have personhood and all these different things that are, you know, important to make a holistic person, you know? So growing up, especially in the family background that I have, which is I come from a very criminalized family background. Most of my family have either experienced incarceration or have engaged in some form of criminal act, either for survival or because, you know, that was the community culture that they were around. They got indoctrinated into criminality. So that's all they knew. So like kind of growing up in a community and in a family that is like that, the average person barely has a high school education, let alone a graduate education. The quality of life that you have and the venues and opportunities for what you can do with your life lessens. And that also plays a part in, as I got older, some of the suicidal thoughts. Again, already feeling like I don't have many options for myself. I don't really have a sense of personhood. And then as I get older, the systemic issues that I'm, you know, forced to face due to the lack of like generational wealth and pedigree and the kind of culture that I'm being raised around and in, you know, kind of played a factor in all that too. It withered me down a lot. I mean, withered down with my expectations for my own life, how long I can live that life, what I can do within that life. And even if happiness was even something that even could be something that can even be fought for, let alone achieved. So that was kind of like how I was growing up. It was just a really tough life and a lot of tough things going on.
Eddie, I want to thank you for sharing that with me, because this is a deeply personal topic and I appreciate your openness to share what you did. Saying that you were as young as three, having thoughts of harming yourself because of what was happening to you and what you were seeing around you, it reminds me of a conversation I had with another psychologist just about how a child being that young, having those sorts of thoughts of harming themselves, it's unfathomable for a lot of people.
Yeah, sometimes these experiences, the thoughts can like manifest in a young person at a very young age. And sometimes it's tied to trauma. Sometimes it's not really tied to trauma. That tends to be the issue that most folks tend to misunderstand when it comes to suicide ideation, that it's always trauma informed or trauma brought, which isn't always the case. Sometimes people, you know, their minds or their brains or whatever it may have you, just doesn't really function in a sense that self-preservation and the sustaining of the self is really important.
That also makes me think that we have to bring in resources to address these problems a lot earlier. I'm wondering, if you received medical attention, what was that journey like for you? Because it's documented that mental health and substance use are often under-recognized, under-treated, and misdiagnosed in Black youth.
Yeah, so there was medical intervention in my early adolescence. By the time I got into young childhood, so around the age of, I would say like 9, we really didn't do therapy all that often. And it really wasn't really that highly recognized. I think, I don't really remember what stopped us going to therapy. But all I remember is that it wasn't really a thing that was consistently part of my schedule. And at some point, it kind of phased out of my life. But the things that I were dealing with, both like in within my life, both as well as the suicidal thoughts that I was experiencing, were still going on. And then as I got older, it entered puberty, and then like experiences of like exploring my sexual orientation start to play a factor into that. And again, this is the early 2010s or late 2000s, so like things weren't really, even now things aren't really always PG keen for queer people. Yeah. But even back then, it was like, at that young of an age, is like trying to figure those things out. And you hear that you don't know what you are, you know, but yeah, you're being bombarded with messages that being a certain way makes you wrong, you know? Yeah. So that, you know, adds on top of that too. And then the dealing with mental health issues. So like dealing with depression and bipolar disorder and ADHD were the things that were just on top of me as well.
Now, speaking of school, your peers, your family, I know you mentioned your mom really noticed what was happening to you and did what she could. Did people at your school, your friends, did they know you were struggling with your mental health, especially with suicidal thoughts? And did they know how to help?
To speak about my mom, when I was young, she was the one who kind of got me to therapy and everything. And like I said, she was the one who walked in and saw me trying to commit an act of self-harm. So she was really involved, as much as a young woman who got pregnant when she was a teenager, and as a form that she could be, you know, yeah, as a young Black mother could be. And even then, there were still particular pitfalls and loopholes that she just did not understand to communicate with me or be present for me with. And that's nothing against her. It's just that, you know, we all can't be informed and educated and prepared for everything. So there's just going to be those pitfalls. And I think with my family, like most folks, I really didn't feel like understood. Sometimes when people hear about someone like committing suicide, the first thing you usually hear is like, oh, that's sad. And then they say, I don't understand, why would someone do something like that?
Yeah.
And then it's that framework that the average human being just don't understand. Why would a person even have those type of thoughts and feelings, and what would drive them to commit such an act? There's also the factor that sometimes, again, not everyone's informed. So not everyone has the ability to create space for people to talk, but then not everyone even have the language to even be in conversation about these kinds of topics. And sometimes when you want to talk about it, you feel like you don't really have anyone to talk to, or you don't have the ability to take up emotional capital about this. You know, you can't, you know, be big and sad Especially in certain spaces where, you know, being big and sad and very transparent about the fact that you're thinking about self-harming yourself can get you admitted. But not a whole lot of people want that experience or want to go back to such an experience. I personally never really been admitted, and hearing stories from friends and peers I've had that were, never want to experience something like that. So you really can't take emotional capital, because some people look at that like, oh, red flag. This is an unstable emotional person. Like we have to lock them up somewhere and do something about that.
Were you ever embarrassed that you were having struggles with your mental health?
Yeah, there was a sense of embarrassment, because you do recognize there's something different about yourself from other people, and that other people got this thing about them where they, I don't know, not, I don't want to say like value themselves, because I want to say that not all people who experience suicidal ideation don't value themselves, because that's not always the case, but they have this thing where they don't have to carry that weight with them, and you can tell. It does get embarrassing, because you're like, why can I be like that? Why am I always thinking about this thing, or always feel like I'm one inch away from doing something that I might regret? Or and there's also the factor that you know, you can sometimes feel shame, especially with how some people usually just have like talk about suicidal ideation, and how you try to pull people from out of that, because oftentimes people try to say, to pull someone from out of that type of thinking is, well, you have so many people that care about you. You have all these friends. And it's kind of weird to say if you don't know that person to say those type of things, because you don't know if they do have a community or support system that care about them. And even if they do, you don't know if that's a healthy one. You don't know if that's contributing to why they have these thoughts and feelings. Also, it's kind of like emotional guilt tripping in a sense. Like, how dare you not want to be here, then what all the things you got to do for other people, and all the people that rely on
or
you,
or like you're selfish.
Like you're selfish, and it's like, I'm not selfish because I think about this and I feel this. It's a lot of stress, it's a lot of shame, it's a lot that I really don't want to be thinking about. So yeah, it's a there is a lot of like embarrassment, and like I say, like you don't really get the emotional capital to talk about it, so that embarrassment deepens. Because like you don't have a community to like kind of go to and just be yourself with, you know. In a few spaces that people have, like online spaces that where people go to talk about suicidal ideation and self-harm, aren't really always the healthiest. And they always don't really create avenues to get support or tools of a betterment. Not to say that all the spaces are like that, but like sometimes the internet is not the best space to try to find community, especially when it comes to mental health. You know.
Eddie, is suicidal ideation something that always lingers with you? And if so, what helps you?
So I went on a long and treacherous journey on dealing with my suicidal ideation. And it's something that still exists. I still think about it. It's still pitter patters in my head like a baby with like a newborn baby or something. But over years of learning to advocate for myself and kind of that being the vessel in which I've actually ended up getting more help for myself was through advocacy. It made my life a bit better. It made managing that a little bit better. It made developing a sense of self-preservation easier. It's like, you know, yes, I'm dealing with this. Yes, I have these thoughts, but I owe it to myself to at least have an experienceable life, you know?
Yeah.
I owe it to myself to at least, you know, exist, even if I'm not happy with it. You know, I owe myself at least that bare minimum. So I just owe it to myself to exist.
Eddie Kennedy is a mental health advocate. He spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, in 2023. To help break the stigma, a Milwaukee area podcast is giving teens a platform to talk about their mental health. Every other week, the teenage hosts of the Wish You Knew podcast sit down with their teen guests to reflect on their mental health journeys. Lake Effect's Exgrit Nunez spoke with Levy Stein, the executive director of the Friendship Circle of Wisconsin, which is the organization that produces the podcast. She also spoke with Lizzie Thurow, a co-host of the podcast. Stein begins by explaining what the Friendship Circle does.
The Friendship Circle is a local nonprofit organization that works to provide opportunities of friendship for people with disabilities and those struggling with mental health. There are so many vulnerable populations that are so isolated, and we want to give them that opportunity to be included, to be productive members of society. No one should struggle alone. And we do that through a variety of different programming. So on the disability side, we have social recreational program for both children and adults with disabilities, like Friends at Home, where teen volunteers visit the homes of kids with disabilities, to, again, like bowling or adaptive softball or taekwondo, all kinds of fun and exciting stuff. We also have a coffee shop, a bakery, and an art studio in Fox Point that houses our employment training program for adults with disabilities, and that is open to the public that anyone can come in and enjoy. On the mental health side, which is our You Matter division of Friendship Circle, we do a lot of suicide prevention trainings. We do teen mental health support groups. We do other mental health related events and programming. And of course, the Wish You Knew podcast.
So I definitely see how this project dovetails with the mission of the Friendship Circle and You Matter. So the Wish You Knew podcast introduces listeners to teen guests who have struggled and overcome significant mental health challenges. How did the idea to create this podcast come about?
So I served on the Committee of Office of Children's Mental Health, which is a statewide committee, and we did a lot of research on what is the need for our society's youth in the field of mental health. And one of the outcomes of all that research and study was peer support. That was one big piece. And another piece was youth voice, not having an opportunity for our kids to really share how they feel. And at the same time, I know just with working with kids with disabilities, and even as a kid myself, I was a kid at one point, we're always being told by other adults what to do. And we're not necessarily looking for that always. Sometimes we just need a peer to just support, you know, one another. And also when it comes to mental health, having a genuine conversation with another peer is so different than when you're talking to an adult who's kind of trying to fix you or make you better or whatever. Right. When it's two kids talking, it's just a more genuine conversation. And that's how the podcast idea came up, where all the other mental health podcasts out there are really adults or experts that are talking to others. Here, it's not about the expert background. It's about two kids having a conversation and giving the world an opportunity to hear what's going through our youth today, what's happening to them. And then, of course, for so many of the teens that are listening, to not feel alone.
Right. I'm also curious, why is the podcast named Wish You Knew? Is there a story behind that?
There's always a story. It's really about, we started an event called One Thing I Wish You Knew. This was an in-person event that we did 3 years ago, and we had four teens sharing their story in person to a large audience. And it was called One Thing I Wish You Knew because we wanted them to share in their story, what do they wish people knew and understood about their mental health journey? And close to 500 people showed up. It was an incredible, incredible event. And after that happened, we're like, we're so sad that we only allowed four teens to speak, and they were only able to speak for 4 minutes each. There's so many more kids that have a story to share, and they need more time than just 4 minutes. So again, the podcast was born.
Wow. I'm also wondering, Lizzie, hello. You and Autumn are both the season two hosts of Wish You Knew. Autumn, unfortunately, couldn't be here today. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm curious, how does the editing work for this, for the podcast?
Sure. Yeah, so Autumn and I came in to this podcast not really knowing a whole lot about editing. YouTube really solved a lot of our inquiries, which is great. So we record the episodes. It takes about 40-minute long conversations, and we really try and keep it conversational-based, not an interview where I'm asking question after question. We want it to feel authentic because it is a vulnerable situation. So we go back and forth, and after this back and forth, we take our recordings home and we sit down and we listen to every single one of them. We really just listen through to make sure it sounds like an authentic conversation. Oftentimes this takes like 4 hours, and it's really only a 30-minute segment. We put a lot of work into the editing, and we had to learn a lot throughout it. And then after the fact, like Levy noted, we send over our rough draft, if you will, to Levy. He sends that to the You Matter committee, and they let us know if they have any suggestions. Sometimes they'll have us edit out certain language. That's something I learned a lot about in the first episode, where we were talking about our own stories, Autumn and I, and something that part of language that I used often was crazy. I'd talk about my story and I'd say, you know, I thought it was crazy X, Y, and Z. And I never thought once that that was a poor word choice because it was about me. But when I recognized that this was going to be shared with a lot of people who might be able to find themselves in a similar situation, they shouldn't have a word with that connotation, if you will, relating to something so vulnerable about them. So that's something we learned a lot about. I think that we learned a lot about the way in which to address conversations and steer them, as well as just things to keep off the table, like medications, stuff like that, that you would never think of before.
So I'm curious as to how this opportunity came up and why did you, Lizzie, decide to become a host of this podcast?
Sure. So I am a senior student at the University School of Milwaukee, and something kind of interesting that our school brings up is the opportunity for a transcript designation. And what I chose to do with this, there's a whole bunch of different options. I chose to look down the path of service. So I spent the first 3 years of my high school career doing hours and hours of service. I worked a lot with the healthcare realm in service, and so I did some research on that. And then your senior year, you need to do an internship or a tower project. I ended up doing both. Long story short, through this, one of my friends from the class works with Levy. Her name's Hannah. And she told me that Levy was looking for someone to be a podcast host. And I never, ever thought about joining a podcast before this. But she said, I know you have a story, and I think it could be a really great opportunity for you. So I worked up the courage. I went over, I met Levy, and I had an interview with him. And we talked for, I want to say, 15 minutes. And after that, he had me submit a recording where I would mock interview someone in my life. So I did that with my mom. And after a couple of days, Levy called me and let me know that I and another person were able to become hosts. And I was very surprised by this. I did not think I had anything in me to be able to become a host, but it was very exciting. And in the small world that we live in, the two people that Levy ended up contacting with were me and then my friend Autumn, who also goes to USM and who has been one of my great friends for plenty of years. So we decided we were going to do it. And I think all along, I was super excited about the idea, but I didn't realize that I was going to have to go share my mental health journey. And that was a lot for me. Of course, I knew what I was about to do, but I didn't take it into heart. So going in and sharing my story and being vulnerable was something really difficult for me because the stigma, I think, is so hard out there and it's so overpowering. So just working up the courage to be able to share my story for the better good of me and everyone else out there listening who might be able to relate was something that I really had to overcome. And I feel like I've come a long way in the mental health realm, being able to go out and become an advocate throughout this podcast.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that with me. And yeah, I was going to ask you, in the first episode of this season, you and Autumn both share your journey navigating mental health challenges and how you overcame them. But I guess, what made you want to share your story? I know you listed a couple of things.
Sure. So I have had my fair journey with mental health from a young age. I had a lot to do with anxiety and some seasonal depression in my past. And a lot of time, despite having a great support system at home, my family was very supportive. They found me therapists. They got me all the resources that I could ever want. I didn't want to talk about it because I was scared that it made me less than, that this was something that was all in my head and I couldn't control it. And I had that mindset for a long time in my life, that this was something I kept quiet. This was my issue, no one else's. And I think the opportunity that this podcast presented was to overcome the stigma in the mental health community. There's so much stigma about this is your burden. No one else has to worry about it. And that's not true. Mental health is just as important as physical health. And I think that this podcast making me overcome those thoughts has really taught me a lot about it. And I'm just so proud to be able to sit here now and say that I am stronger than the stigma. And being a part of this podcast, I'm no expert, but just having these conversations can help a lot of other students in a similar situation overcome the stigma for themselves as well.
Absolutely. And I do want to mention, like, some of the conversations The conversations on the podcast range from one guest talking about their struggles with body image and anorexia, another guest experiencing depression while recovering from a sports injury, and someone else, you know, navigating feelings of isolation after immigrating to the U.S. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's important to give young people this platform to be vulnerable and share these difficult experiences?
Sure. So, like I said earlier, there's no one story for mental health. There's so many different things. And the stigma a lot of times, too, will have you have to define your journey. And I think that something interesting about this podcast is there's no right or wrong way to have a mental health journey. So Levy has been very adamant about having a whole plethora of stories ranging from all the things that you were talking about earlier. And I think that this podcast is important and ultimately show all of our audience, you may not feel like you have a great support system, but we hope that this podcast can be a form of support in your life and recognize that you are not alone and that it's a journey for a reason. There is a light at the end of the tunnel, but this is just one step to finding that light. So I think that coming on this podcast, showing that vulnerability helps people in the long run, being able to overcome that stigma in the mental health realm and ultimately anywhere else in their life. So it's really a great life skill that Levy is implementing into the youth generation.
Before we wrap up, I want to take it back to the beginning. Levy, do you feel like the Friendship Circle of Wisconsin is accomplishing what it originally set out to do with the Wish You Knew podcast?
It's definitely making progress towards it. I mean, we definitely need to get the word out. There are so many kids right now that are still struggling alone. There are so many people in our community still having thoughts of suicide. So many people that are going through something that no one should have to go through, but many are, and they don't need to go through it alone. And until everyone is feeling connected, we're not going to stop.
Well, Lizzie and Levy, thank you both so much for sharing your work with me. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having us in.
Levy Stein is the executive director of the Friendship Circle of Wisconsin, the organization that produces the Wish You Knew podcast. Lizzie Thoreau is a co-host of the Wish You Knew podcast, and they both joined Lake Effect's Ex-Grid Nunez. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Did you also know that Barbie is from Wisconsin? We'll learn about the iconic doll's history in about 15 minutes. But first, we'll visit the historic Mitchell Street Library to explore the community kitchen housed in its makerspace. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The library has a wealth of programming and resources to offer, including makerspaces. Kids and adults can access anything from craft supplies to recording equipment. Inside the makerspace in the Mitchell Street branch is the Cargo Community Kitchen. It's run by Sherry Agee, who's been in the food service industry for over 20 years. To learn about the kitchen and the programming offered for the community, I met with AG in the makerspace. Before we get into the space we're in right now, I want to know where your passion for food and cooking comes from.
Primarily from my childhood, so stemming from my mother and my older sister preparing meals for the family growing up and just wanting to essentially be under their wing and learn how they were able to transform these ingredients to family meals that just became, you know, custom in our home. But that sparked my passion for creativity and then also wanting to serve. So that was, I would say, the birth of my culinary journey.
Well, and it's important to have family that are supportive and welcoming in the kitchen, right? It's easy to get overwhelmed and be like, kids out of the kitchen, you know? But how do you think that openness fostered that to begin with, and the importance of inviting people in to these spaces and also learning new skills?
It's the environment of a free space and where people feel safe to, one, be themselves and just have the courage to try new things, whether it's a new ingredient or learning about a new concept of food, a new technique on how to transform food. That environment is something that I felt at home, and I wanted to transcend that in the library space.
So before you came to the library, I'm curious about your own history in the culinary arts before you took the position of kitchen consultant here. So can you share some more of your food background that you made a career of?
Sure. So I started my culinary education at a junior college in Illinois in the food service management program, and then transferred to MATC's culinary arts program. And since then have been continuing my education with different certifications. ServSafe is a food safety program that I have became certified in, but also and now in a position to teach as an instructor. So very excited about that, making individuals who also want to pursue a career in the food service industry to be better equipped. And then just a whole plethora of experience from mom and pop restaurants, the health industry, hospitals, assisted living centers, the travel sector. I've worked at General Mitchell with one of the top food service providers, and then my own catering business.
Yeah, certainly a wealth of experience. And you joined MPL in the spring of 2022, and a major part of your initial work was rebuilding the library's culinary program after the pandemic, right? Which was a huge shift and challenge for many of us and all the jobs we do. So what were some of the main challenges or action items that stand out to you looking back at your first period of time starting here?
I would say just opening the door of people getting to know who I was. I was new to patrons, and the previous consultants, they already had established that culture with them and relationship with them. So me coming on board, just establishing the rapport with patrons, and then again, the environment that I wanted to create in our makerspace to just foster that sense of community and rebuilding what was lost or certainly diminished during the pandemic. It's just really just restructuring that and making people feel welcome and safe and being able to just reconnect.
Yeah, that's so important. You mentioned the makerspace, which is where we're sitting in right now at the Cargill Kitchen. Can you share more about the background of this kitchen and what it's named after?
So the Cargill Community Kitchen is made possible by the Cargill Company. So they had partnered with Milwaukee Public Library by way of creating this magnificent space to provide food programming. We are the one and only branch in the library, Milwaukee Public Library network, to offer food programming on this level because it is a full-scale community kitchen. The output of what has been created through different avenues of weekly series of food programmings and what we call special events, like our community meals, all are made possible by way of the community kitchen.
So you mentioned community meals. You also have programs such as Snack Hack, and I know the options of what you want to cook and prepare for the community are probably endless. So what are some of your guiding principles that help you shape your programming for the community here?
I do want to explore food options that, from my experience, most people may not have tried, because this might be the first experience for them right here at the library. So some common items I will add in the mix in terms of the menu that is supporting the Snack Hack curriculum, but I do want to continue adding those new experiences as well. So different ingredients that might be oddball to most of the patrons, I definitely want to expose them to learning that new piece that they can take home as a addition to their culinary awareness.
You mentioned an ingredient or a meal you might introduce may be someone's first exposure to that. Mm-hmm. So what are, say, some recipes, for example, that you help to share with people to kind of give them that introductory lesson, but also the recipe that's not too complicated, that it scares them away or intimidates them from a kitchen experience?
One that was most recently used in our World Cuisine section in our Snack Hack series was Caribbean themed. So we had traveled to Jamaica, and one of the ingredients called for a jerk seasoning, which a lot of the patrons were familiar with the commercially made blends, not really realizing that they can make this at home. And being able to learn how ingredients come together to get the results that you want in learning how to transform food was definitely an eye-opener for a lot of patrons.
There's the whole excitement and tool of being resourceful in the kitchen, whether it's making your own spice blends or knowing what to do with an ingredient and the versatility of it. So what is some of the feedback or takeaways you hear from attendees, and what kind of range of people do you see in your classes?
The feedback from the attendees have always been positive and a strong sense of gratefulness. A lot of patients will say, oh, I didn't know. I mean, even just as simple as the proper way of cooking rice. When I explained, you know, the general ratio of water to rice and the cooking technique to get the texture for that grain of rice, something that was seen, you know, that's like culinary 101 for me, but something very basic. I don't want to overlook that and not teach that to the attendees who may not know. And they're struggling in the kitchen. They're trying to figure out, well, why isn't this coming out right? Why is my rice mushy? And being able to walk through that when I do the cooking demonstrations are probably the biggest feedback from attendees. The age range is pretty vast. There are toddlers, so early elementary age in the Snack Hack Kids Kitchen program, all the way up to senior citizens that attend the Snack Hack 2.0, or I'll say my seasoned attendees
yes.
That attend Snack Hack 2.0, which is the adult program. Both are centered on food and nutrition, but the age groups are split to better suit the learning level.
So no matter the meal that you're preparing and helping to walk through with people, what are the main takeaways you hope your attendees take away from your time with them in the kitchen?
Be open to learning and to not be afraid in the kitchen. That it's okay to make mistakes. I literally explained that a lot of recipes were mistakes. That's how they came to be, is because it was a arbitrary use of ingredients or a cooking technique, and then bam, it turned into this great recipe, and then it became documented and then duplicated, and now we have this kind of standardized recipe for something that originated as a mistake. So just being open to trying new foods or learning a new way to prepare a dish, and just not being afraid of your own creativity. You're not limited with food. There's so many possibilities, and even that is kind of is an understatement.
And I feel like that's one main intimidation roadblock for people, because they think cooking and baking is strict and you have to follow a recipe. And while for baking especially, like, yes, some components are important in order for it to turn out well, but you can put your own spin on it. And like, if you like certain flavors, you can add more of this and subtract some of that. And I think reminding people to be creative and embrace mistakes can help break down those initial barriers of intimidation that a lot of people face.
Exactly. I actually, in almost every session, I always explain that recipes are a guideline. With baking, yes, it is more of a science, because too much baking powder in a recipe could completely destroy it. But with recipes where you have that flexibility, I always explain it to make it to your palate. So certain recipes that might have a heat element. I recently made a chili casserole from our historic recipe file, and it called for cinnamon, which was unique. That was actually the first chili recipe of all the chilies I've made. That was the first recipe that called for cinnamon. I was like, that's a unique ingredient, but I wanted to try it only because I was unfamiliar with it. And once that chili was cooked and I presented it, I did not have enough to serve everyone, including seconds. So they were open to trying something new. None of the attendees had heard of cinnamon in a chili recipe, just like myself. So we were learning together, which is also just a great element in food programming as well when we are on this journey together.
What are some of your favorite parts of this job and some of the new challenges you get to meet with each meal?
It is the creativity, first and foremost, and then just the broader platform versus the weekly series. The community meal attendance is significantly larger. The average count is 65 versus about 18 to 20 for the weekly programs. And then the community meals are themed. So I love the opportunity to pick a specific concept, or if it's a seasonal focus, I get to, I don't want to say play around with it, but I get to have the broader platform to reach more people. And they are attending in big numbers. So we are doing a great, or meeting a great need, because they're returning and they're coming back and they're sharing their experiences. And this is an opportunity that they probably wouldn't expect at the library, because it is non-traditional, but the community meals are my way of being able to break the mold and to show the evolution of libraries.
Well, Sherry, I want to thank you so much for welcoming me into your space today and for sharing more.
Thank you very much. Hope to see you soon.
Sherry Agee is the Cargill Community Kitchen Consultant at the Milwaukee Public Library Mitchell Street branch. We spoke earlier this year. There is a series of snack hack programs throughout July happening at the kitchen, and you can find out more information about that at mpl.org. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk going, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area that you've always wondered about at wuwm.com. We'll take one more break, and when we return, we'll learn about the original Barbie doll and how Barbie's origin story has ties to Wisconsin. Keep listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Barbie summer may be behind us, but Barbie dolls are forever a part of our culture. The Wisconsin Historical Society has an original model of that first Barbie doll in a black and white striped bathing suit, which dates back to 1961. And fun fact, Barbie is actually from Wisconsin. I'm joined by Abby Norderhau, the Director of Acquisitions and State Archivist for the Wisconsin Historical Society, to learn more. So you actually have one of these original models in your collection. Where did this Barbie come from?
So the Barbie doll that the Wisconsin Historical Society has in their collection is from 1961. So it's a little bit different than that original. The primary difference being that our Barbie has pearl earrings and the original has the hoop earrings. So the Barbie that we have was purchased by Orville and Francine Fox, who lived in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And they actually purchased that Barbie specifically for their granddaughter, Beth Fox, so that when she came to visit them from Madison, she would have something to play with.
And Barbie apparently has some Wisconsin roots. She's supposedly from the fictional town of Willows, Wisconsin. Do we know any more about this and her Midwest origin story?
Barbie is from Willows, Wisconsin, and that was confirmed in a series of books published by Random House starting in 1960, where it was confirmed that Barbie graduated from high school in Willows, Wisconsin. However, the story has changed a little bit over the years. In Barbie Dreamhouse Adventures, which was a television program, the story was changed so that Barbie moved from Willows, Wisconsin when she was 8 years old to settle in Malibu. We don't know where Willows is in Wisconsin, but it's sort of the idea that Ruth Handler had when she created the Barbie doll was that every girl should be able to see herself in Barbie. So centering Barbie in the Midwest and in a small town makes her very accessible.
And when Barbie debuted, it was two mixed reviews, honestly. So what were some sort of the concerns that, you know, everyone from doll buyers to even the heads of Mattel had?
Barbie was a really unique product when she was introduced. At that time, most dolls aimed at little girls were baby dolls, sort of with the idea that it would let them envision themselves as mothers and let them play in kind of a caretaking role. And the idea of Barbie that Ruth had was that Barbie should be what any little girl could envision her future to be. So having Barbie as an adult rather than a child made little girls think about their future and think about what they could be when they grew up. I think it's notable because Ruth herself was a female executive at a time when female executives were fairly uncommon. And so she was giving girls an avenue to see themselves maybe in a business role or in one of the many other careers that Barbie has had over the years.
One of the main hurdles of the design of Barbie was the fact that she was mature, that she had breasts, that she had long legs, and, you know, was something that made, obviously, all the male executives uncomfortable. And Ruth was trying to explain the concept, and she came across something called the Lily Doll on a trip to Switzerland in the summer of 1956 that kind of modeled what she was trying to conceptualize. Can you explain a bit more about the Lily Doll and why it's significant in Barbie's origin?
Sure. So, Ruth Handler had noticed that her daughter preferred to play with adult women paper dolls rather than baby dolls. And then she was on a trip in Switzerland and came across this Lily doll, which was an adult female doll. And she had her daughter with her at the time. And both she and her daughter were sort of captivated by this doll and the possibilities that there were there. So she bought one of those dolls and brought it back with her and used it as a model to make the modern Barbie doll. And that idea of an adult female doll with an adult female body was new at the time, and I think was probably hard for people to accept and to envision such a change in what kids were playing with.
And while Barbie has had several different careers in her lifetime as a toy, this first Barbie doll was primarily for the fashion accessories, right?
Absolutely. So Barbie's first career was as a teenage fashion model. And one of the things that's really interesting about Barbie and that Lily doll that it was based on is that Barbie, you could purchase individual outfits for her and really expand your collection that way. Whereas the Lily doll, you had to purchase a new doll to get different outfits for that doll. Ruth talked about seeing a Lily doll in a beautiful ski sweater and realizing that in order to get that ski sweater, you had to have a whole other doll. So her idea was that making the clothing interchangeable and selling it separately would really allow for more avenues of play.
And talking about those other clothing accessories, what other clothing items are with this Barbie in your collection here that you have?
This Barbie has a couple other outfits, mainly party dress style outfits. So a couple different pink longer dresses, a skirt. One thing that's really interesting about the Barbie we have in our collection and Barbies in general is the homemade clothing. It used to be so much more common for people to sew their own clothing rather than get it off the rack at a store. And we see that in our collection as well. So we have some commercially made Barbie clothes as well as Barbie clothes that people sewed for their dolls to kind of customize their looks.
So along with Barbie's popularity as this doll made its footing in the toy world and in popular culture, there was and still is some criticisms of this iconic doll. So what are some of the main negative perceptions that Barbie has?
Obviously, one of the main criticisms of Barbie is her body shape. It's not a realistic woman's body shape. And there's been thoughts over the years that that might contribute to girls and women feeling badly about their own bodies. She's also often blonde, and the first Barbie was white. It wasn't until the 1960s that there was an African-American Barbie doll. So she doesn't necessarily represent all people in that way. There's also been some criticism that the initial African-American Barbie was still the same body and face mold as Barbie, just a different color. And so although Barbie strove to be more equal early on, it wasn't with a different model that might more reflect what different folks look like.
And the Barbie design has changed over the years as well, while trying to remain somewhat recognizable to this original doll that we're talking about today. But one thing that Barbie has maintained over the years is her independence. And what are some of the other positives that are associated with Barbie?
Sure. Well, Barbie and Ken have never married. So Barbie has remained an independent woman since 1959 when she was introduced. I think some other positives of Barbie are that imagination. Barbie has had so many different careers that different girls and children can envision themselves having. She's also been an avenue for imagination and exploratory play. So really letting people open up their imaginations and think big about their future.
Obviously, the Barbie movie by Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie has added to this conversation about this toy and what it represents. So for you personally, how do you see Barbie? And how do you appreciate this artifact from the Wisconsin Historical Society?
I had Barbies growing up, so I've always had a soft spot for Barbie. One thing that I think is really interesting about the Barbie in our collection is the way it tells a story of childhood from 1961, and it connects so concretely with childhood today. It shows how Beth Fox was playing with her doll. If you look at the Barbie, we have her hair's in a French braid. She's had her clothing changed. So you can see that this Barbie was used and played with. And it really shows how Beth interacted with her and how she enjoyed that doll. And I think when you look at Barbies today, you still see that kids are using them to play and tell stories with. Kate McKinnon's character of Weird Barbie is a great example of that, where you know, the Weird Barbie has been drawn on and clearly used and loved by a child. And you can see that in the Barbie that we have in our collection.
And I love that. And the fact that museum collections often show things that have been used in real life. It's not like a collector's item, though those have their place, obviously, too. But the fact that this was actually used and taken care of is special.
Absolutely. We always say we try to collect what we call game used. So we really want to see how people have used things and interacted with those things to improve their lives.
Well, Abby, thanks so much for joining me to talk about Barbie today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Abby Norderhau is the Director of Acquisitions and State Archivist for the Wisconsin Historical Society. We spoke back in 2023 at the height of Barbie Mania. And that wraps up Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll get a preview of the music you'll be able to hear at the Summer of Soul event series happening at the Peck Pavilion this summer. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.